Welcome to the Corner of Film podcast. I'm Niall from Corner of Film, which is a film website where I write about film. You are listening to the latest in a series of mini episodes in which I dive into some of the weird and wonderful occurrences in Hollywood. Over the past few weeks, we've looked at actor deaths, untold stories behind films, cursed productions, and more, but for this episode, I've decided to lighten things up a little. As those who follow me personally might know, that's at Lord of the Grey on Twitter if you're interested, my partner and I rescued a puppy last week, and that got me thinking about some of the film industry's most underappreciated actors. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to rant about why I believe Nicolas Cage is a genius, or why Kristen Stewart deserves a fair shake. No, today I'd like to talk about animal actors. Animals have been on film for just as long as humans. Longer, in fact, as the first ever moving pictures showed a galloping horse, but they rarely get the recognition they deserve. After all, how many among us actually bother to learn the real names of animal actors? If you do, please remember that this is a podcast and that the questions I ask are meant to be rhetorical. Also, you know, good for you. With all that in mind, I'd like to walk you through the stories of some of the greatest and most interesting non-human actors of all time. Today's episode starts back in 1996, when a company creatively called Birds and Animals Unlimited was tasked with purchasing a capuchin monkey in Florida. Usually, Birds and Animals would pick up younger monkeys of around 1 year old, as they were, generally speaking, easier to train. On this particular trip though, the trainer came back with three new recruits, two younger monkeys and a female capuchin named Crystal, who, at the time, was around 2.5 years old, more than double the age of her travelling companions. The monkeys were taken to Tom Gunderson, a relatively experienced trainer, and he stepped aside to let his colleagues choose their new wards first. They each chose one of the younger monkeys, leaving Gunderson with Crystal. This proved to be one of the best decisions that Tom Gunderson ever made. Gunderson took Crystal with him to his job at the Animal Actors stage show at Universal Studios Florida. Here she would live among the hustle and bustle, surrounded by pyrotechnics and audiences of thousands of excitable spectators. In Gunderson's own words, the experience was something of a boot camp for Crystal, explaining that it was a great way for a monkey to grow up and become habituated to that kind of environment. During her time at the Animal Actors stage show, Crystal proved herself to be singularly mature, preferring to groom herself and play with the children's activity centre than to destroy stuffed animals like many of the other monkeys would do in their spare time. No judgement, it just seemed clear that Crystal was on another level. It didn't take long after meeting Gunderson for Crystal to start landing movie roles. Within a year of being in Gunderson's care, Crystal found herself with a part alongside Brendan Fraser in 1997's George of the Jungle. From there, she went on to star in a slew of Hollywood blockbusters. I'm going to list them now, but be warned, it's quite a long list. Crystal the Monkey starred in Dr. Dolittle and Dr. Dolittle 2, American Pie, Garfield the Movie, all three Night at the Museum movies, Failure to Launch, The Hangover Part 2 and The Hangover Part 3, Zookeeper, We Bought a Zoo, Fun with Dick and Jane, The Shaggy Dog, 310 to Yuma, and Marvel's short film All Hail the King. She was also featured in a recurring role on Community, as well as making appearances on Malcolm in the Middle, Animal Practice, and The Big Bang Theory. Crystal's easily identifiable by her unique smile. She actually damaged a lower canine while trying to open a walnut, causing a slight gap in her teeth. She's also incredibly well-loved and well-respected in the industry, being named Hollywood's Hottest Monkey and the Most Powerful Pet in Hollywood. Ken Jeong, who's worked with Crystal on the Hangover films Community and Zookeeper, described the capuchin as amazing. He went on to say that she's not a monkey, she's an actor, and quite possibly the best actor I've worked with. I can't imagine Jeong's Community co-star Chevy Chase was altogether happy to hear that. Now, the average life expectancy of a capuchin in the wild is anywhere between 15 and 25 years old, but in captivity they've been known to live up to 50. Crystal is currently 27 years of age and still lives with Gunderson in his LA home. There she gets a minimum of 8 hours sleep each night in the bed she shares with Gunderson, his wife, and another female capuchin named Squirt. We're going to go from one of my absolute favourite members of the animal kingdom to another. Our next actor is none other than Jimmy the Raven, also known as Jimmy the Crow. Yes, I am aware that his name makes him sound like a mobster from a pulp novel, but I'm just collecting the facts, and boy, is there a lot to know about Jimmy. It's a long-established tradition that filmmakers will regularly seek to collaborate with the same actors. There's Tim Burton and Johnny Depp, Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro, Wes Anderson and Owen Wilson, and Frank Capra and Jimmy the Raven. Jimmy is arguably best known for his role in Capra's festive classic It's a Wonderful Life, where he can be glimpsed in just about every scene set inside George Bailey's building in Lone, but he was also the unofficial mascot of the legendary Frank Capra, and after the Byrds' debut in 1938's You Can't Take It With You, he was given a part in every subsequent film that Capra made. Jimmy was discovered by Hollywood animal trainer Curly Twyford. His real name was Henry Wagstaff Twyford, which is only marginally better. Twyford found Jimmy in a nest in the Mojave Desert and, naturally, decided to take him home. Twyford soon discovered how easy it was to train Jimmy, and before long he had the bird performing tricks, such as typing, opening letters, and even riding his own little motorbike. Seriously, this guy snatched a raven from its nest, then taught it to ride a motorcycle. I honestly have no idea how I'm supposed to feel about this story. Jimmy understood hundreds of English words, although Twyford claimed that only around 50 of them were words that he deemed useful. It would take Jimmy just a week to learn new single-syllable words. Hollywood legend James Stewart spoke highly of Jimmy, saying that when on the set of It's a Wonderful Life, if someone were called Jimmy, both he and the bird would usually appear together. He also shared that Jimmy was the smartest actor on set. As Jimmy's popularity grew, MGM insured him for $10,000. That equates to over $150,000 today, which should give you some idea of just how much of a rock star this bird truly was. It was claimed by Twyford that Jimmy appeared in over 1,000 films, which seems ludicrous, but honestly, he did have some jaw-dropping credits to his name. As well as It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy appeared in The Secret Garden, God's Country, Miraculous Journey, Three Ring Circus, Son of Dracula, The Enchanted Valley, Call of the Forest, Springtime in the Sierras, alongside Trigger, Roy Rogers' famous horse, more on that later, and he was also in a little film called The Wizard of Oz. If you're rewatching it and you wanted to spot Jimmy, he's the one that lands beside the Scarecrow shortly after he meets Dorothy. It would be practically impossible to substantiate Jimmy's supposed 1,000 appearances, given that he so often went uncredited, but he does have at least 28 confirmed credits over a period of 16 years, and that's certainly impressive in itself. Sadly, we don't really know exactly what became of Jimmy after his last credited appearance in 1954's Three Ring Circus. Curly Twyford died aged 60 just 2 years after, and it seems that Jimmy may have simply jumped on his motorcycle and hit the road. Strangely, around the time that Jimmy's career was winding down, another prolific animal actor was just warming up. Starring with a leading role in 1951's Rhubarb, Orangey the Cat leapt to stardom playing the titular feline who inherits a baseball team from an eccentric millionaire. Honestly, I could probably fill the rest of the podcast just talking about the insanity of Rhubarb, but Orangey himself actually led a pretty noteworthy life. After Rhubarb, he went on to star in a number of films, including The Incredible Shrinking Man, The Matchmaker, and perhaps most notably The Diary of Anne Frank and Breakfast at Tiffany's. One of the most documented facts about Orangey, which is a ridiculous name, can I just say, is that he was known as the meanest cat in Hollywood. He was renowned for occasionally ruining scenes by biting and scratching actors for no apparent reason. You'd think that this might put filmmakers off, but Orangey was actually highly sought after for his ability to stay for several hours. Despite this, once Orangey had had enough, he'd often decide to leave the set, causing production to be shut down while the crew searched for him. Orangey's owner, Frank Inn, actually took to posting guard dogs at studio entrances to keep Orangey from running away. Honestly, the stories about Orangey that have survived make him sound like one of the most difficult cats in show business, but the idea of having to post guards on the set just to keep the actor from running away is enough to make him my hero. While he may have earned a reputation for upsetting the actors he worked with, his legacy in film and TV speaks for itself. The exact cause and date of Orangey's death is unknown, but with a career spanning at least 16 years, it's safe to assume that he died of old age. He was buried in Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Hollywood, alongside his trainer Frank Inn, and he's rubbing shoulders for eternity with the likes of Carrie Fisher, Bill Paxton, Fritz Lang, and Michael Clarke Duncan. Not bad for the meanest cat in Hollywood. There's one final animal that I'd like to mention today. At one point he was a global megastar, but his name has been all but forgotten to the younger generations, and his talents were genuinely something to behold. Golden Cloud was born in San Diego on the 4th of July 1934, the son of a thoroughbred. I'll be honest, I know nothing about horses, but there's a lot of information on Golden Cloud's parentage floating around, so if that sort of thing interests you, maybe give it a quick search, because I'm sure it will make more sense to you than it does to me. What I do know, though, is that Golden Cloud made an early appearance in 1938 film The Adventures of Robin Hood, and shortly after, he was selected by the legendary actor Roy Rogers to appear in his headline debut. Rogers and Golden Cloud made an excellent pair, and after making numerous movies together, Rogers bought the horse. He renamed him Trigger for his, and I quote, quickness of both foot and mind. It's reported that Trigger appeared in all 188 of Rogers' movies, as well as appearing on the Roy Rogers Show on NBC between 1951 and 1957. Trigger didn't receive all this attention for standing around, though. Rogers claimed never to have used reins, whips, or spurs on Trigger, who could apparently respond to simple touch and hand movements. He could also perform numerous impressive feats, such as sitting in a chair, signing his name with an X by holding a crayon in his mouth, shooting a gun, untying ropes, doing the hula, and walking on his back legs. Rogers would also take Trigger on tour with him, and when doing so, the pair would visit sick children in the hospital, where Trigger would walk up several flights of stairs in order to make his appearance. What many consider to be Trigger's greatest trick, though, was something far more mundane. Trigger was entirely housebroken, which Rogers said came in incredibly handy when the pair would stay in hotels, make appearances in hospitals, or were filming their latest project. Trigger knew exactly when he needed to go, and he got himself outside to do it. In short, Trigger was a singularly talented animal, and he was loved by millions. But all things eventually come to an end, and Trigger died just one day short of his 31st birthday in 1965. A heartbroken Rogers decided that he couldn't be without his best friend, and had Trigger mounted. He was then displayed at the Roy Rogers Dale Evans Museum in Victorville, California. Now there is one small footnote to Trigger's story that's both incredibly sad and genuinely entertaining. In 2010, the decision was made to close the Roy Rogers Museum after years of steady decline, and many of its contents were sold at auction. Trigger's remains were among them, and they were sold for $266,500. That's both sad and very disturbing, but while researching, I stumbled across one internet user's thoughts on the closure of the Roy Rogers Museum, and it was far too funny not to share. Someone known only as Last Western commented, "If Trigger could twerk, all the kids would have went to the museum. That's the sad state of our country this generation. Today Trigger, tomorrow all things Western." Indeed, Last Western. Indeed. That concludes this episode of the Corner of Film podcast. I hope you've had as much fun listening as I did making it. Please do go and follow Corner of Film on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube and Facebook, and remember that you can currently listen to the podcast on Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube and Podbean. Wherever you may be on the internet, drop us a follow, like or comment, it's always very much appreciated. And if you'd like to follow me to keep up with the many other projects I'm working on, you can do so at Lord of the Grey on Twitter. I've been Niall from Corner of Film, and you've been entertained? Still no good. Goodbye.